Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I really hope that you all had a wonderful New Year's holiday, that you celebrated on New Year's Eve, watched some football on New Year's Day. But you know what? We are really into it now. The political season has begun again in full force, and there is a lot to talk about. Jim Galloway, of course, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. His column is in the Thursday and Sunday newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog. Hi, Jim.
Zastroiftje. Happy New Year.
We'll get to that a little later in the show. Jim's already practicing his Russian for a conversation we're going to have about Trump and Russia later. Michael Owens, the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, is back with us today. Did you have a good New Year's?
I had a wonderful New Year's. Thanks. Hope you did as well.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. And Chip Lake, a Republican strategist, has joined us. And Chip, Happy New Year to you, too.
Happy New Year to you. Happy to be on the show.
Of course, we swore, and we didn't, but the new Congress was sworn in yesterday in Washington. We now have an all-Republican legislature up there, House and Senate. And, of course, President-elect Trump takes office in just a couple of weeks. And there's so much going on up there that we really wanted to have Tamar Hallerman, the AJC's Washington reporter, join us by phone. Thanks for being with us, Tamar. I know this is a really busy time for you, but we appreciate your carving out some time for us.
Thank you. I wish I knew more Russian words.
Tamar, let me start with you. Let's break down. By now, the people who listen to this show and are pretty much political junkies know that yesterday, Republicans starting this new era of consolidated government had an opportunity to open with a flourish, to establish how much they were going to do for the country. The message was going to be Obamacare is dead. We're going to roll back taxes. And of course, instead, they got caught up in this really strange fight about defanging an independent ethics office, right?
Yeah, and it came as a surprise to everyone. This is the sort of thing where the only people complaining about this office are members of Congress. So it struck a lot of people as a surprise that one of the first things House Republicans would choose to do is not to deal with Obamacare, not to talk about President-elect Trump's priorities. It's to gut this ethics watchdog.
The watchdog, they did it in their caucus. They didn't do it on the floor, of course. Two nights ago, they sprung it on everyone, I believe, Tamar. Nobody was advised in advance they were going to be talking about this. And the complaint is that this independent ethics office, many members feel, has gone too far. It takes anonymous reports on wrongdoing by members of Congress. They've had significant issues where members have been accused of unethical activity and then been cleared very quickly. So they decided that, in fact, it should come under the control of the Ethics Committee of members themselves. Have I got that right?
Yeah, you do. And this is an office or a committee run by members of Congress themselves. And the reason why this independent watchdog was created in 2008 after all of these lobbying scandals was that the House Ethics Committee was seen by many to be to sit on a lot of complaints, to not be as active as a lot of people thought.
Right. And one thing that the OCE did that the House Ethics Committee does not do, it can refer suspected criminal cases to the executive branch.
Right.
The FBI,
exactly,
to whoever.
Exactly. Chip Lake, you're a Republican strategist. Good move.
I think he was there when that office was set up.
Yeah, look, I was. It's not a good move politically, Bill, but it was also not a good move in 2008 to open up the office of OC. I mean, the reality is, most people that go up to Washington are good, honest people with integrity, whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, even though we might have political disagreements. You can't have laws and committees that make people people have integrity. And so what happens is you create an independent committee, you staff it with 12 lawyers, and you're going to end up getting a lot of people stuck in that web who everything becomes unethical.
All right, Chip,
at that point.
Chip. Let me point out, that was then, yeah, and this is now. Was this
correct,
a good image? for the new Congress.
Not at all. What they should have done, Bill, knowing that it is unfair to a lot of them, and Trump even said that yesterday in his tweet, in the two tweets that went out. What they should have done, what I thought they should have done, is take a little bit of the teeth away from it, because anybody can submit a complaint to the office of OCE, and you can do so anonymously. So if you want to try to make things a little bit more transparent, say, you know what, we're still going to have this Office of Congressional Ethics, but if you want to file a complaint that we have to investigate, you got to put your name on it.
Tamar, the news broke overnight after the caucus voted without taking the roll. In other words, that we don't have any official ballot that we can look at, although we're going to get to what you reported on that in a minute in terms of Georgia congressmen. What was the atmosphere like on the Hill the next morning as you went up there and saw Republicans trying to deal with the outrage that the country seemed to be expressing?
Yeah, a lot of chaos and confusion yesterday morning. A lot of them felt like these proposals to change the OCE were valid, but they saw how quickly, especially after Trump tweeted about it, how quickly the tides had turned. Not only from Trump supporters, but you had watchdog groups. You had the press who was very critical, and I think people felt very bombarded. So, you know, within I believe 18 hours, they went back into a meeting to reverse themselves, and apparently that vote was unanimous. So it shows the power of the bully pulpit that that Trump has, especially with his Twitter account.
But it also shows that you've still got a House Republican caucus that is willing to really to cross its leadership.
Yeah, Paul Ryan, the Speaker, had urged that, and the majority leader also, they had urged not to approve this, Tamar, and yet the members did it anyway, which, you know, in addition to the message about ethics themselves, raises questions about whether Paul Ryan is going to be faced with some revolts from his own membership in the weeks ahead.
For sure. And this did not come from the usual suspects. These were not members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus. The initial proposal was written up by a longtime member who's a committee chairman, who's tight with Paul Ryan and members of leadership. So this shows, yeah, you're right, that the caucus might be a lot harder to manage than people thought.
Michael, does this give Democrats some opening? Again, you know, they were just sworn in yesterday. This controversy hit before all of the members were sworn in for the brand new session, and it already puts a little cloud over this new Republican majority on the Hill. Does this give Democrats an opening?
Yes, it gives Democrats an opening. I mean, I think it starts off with looking at how the 115th session has started, right? And I think, you know, initially Republicans going out to really take away the teeth from an independent ethics organization or department that, you know, has really been effective in the past. And I think that, you know, the strange thing with me was seeing the coordination or the coalition that may be developing between Paul Ryan and President-elect Donald Trump. I think, you know, Paul Ryan earlier said that, you know, it was going to be a black eye, right? It was a stain on the Republican caucus. And, you know, so I'm wondering early on, you know, two vicious opponents, if you will, between Paul Ryan and President-elect now seem to be maybe getting a little bit cozier.
Yeah, Trump essentially tweeted, I don't have it in front of me, but there's more important things to deal with.
Oh, right. Yeah, this was about priorities. It wasn't about the matter actually at hand. It was, this just didn't have to be number one on your to-do list.
So go ahead, Jim.
With the exception of, that's the first thing you do as a Congress is pass the rules package.
Exactly.
Tamar, we pointed out already that this vote was in the caucus, which was closed, of course, to the media, not unusual, and therefore there's no recorded vote. But you spent some time tracking down members of Georgia's congressional delegation. How did they respond to your request to know how they voted?
They did not take very kindly to it. One thing we do know, we have a tally. We have a tally for the final vote, how all Republicans voted on the proposal. We know that 119 of them supported it, a huge majority. I reached out to all 10 offices of House Republicans from Georgia multiple times yesterday. I only ever heard back from two of them. Rob Woodall from Lawrenceville and Drew Ferguson, Georgia's newest congressman from West Point, they both said that they voted for it. They think it would lead to improvements in the ethics process on Capitol Hill. And today I walked around and I caught Tom Graves up from Ranger and Austin Scott from Tifton, and both of them declined to say how they voted. They said this is a private matter, a private vote taken behind closed doors, and that it's not their policy to share.
I think there was a real cottage industry yesterday in reporters like yourself chasing Republican members around the halls trying to get them to say how they voted on it. So it is interesting, Tamar, that this is Drew Ferguson's first. First of all, he admitted it to you. I suppose we should give him credit for transparency. But this is an odd way to start your first day as a member of the U.S. House.
Sure. I don't know how much people realized how much this would completely blow up the next morning. But yeah, but yeah, it's an interesting note to start on.
Let's talk about another issue in the rules that has an impact on Georgia congressmen. And that's the rule that was passed yesterday that it includes a sanction, a penalty for open recording or live broadcast from the floor of the House. And, of course, it's a response to the fact that John Lewis and other members last July,
they held a, 24, 26-hour they seized the floor, seized control of the floor.
And John Lewis, of course, one of the leaders of that.
Right, and this was a protest over the failure of Republicans to address gun violence.
So, Tamar, the rule that they passed yesterday includes a provision for garnishing the wages, I believe, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, of members who should record or, I think, broadcast live, either audio or video, from the floor of the House, right?
Exactly. And what's interesting about this is not a fine that lawmakers pay later, or maybe they say, I don't feel like paying this, I'm not going to pay it. They garnish their wages. So lawmakers don't have a choice if they break this rule.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this is, and also it kind of prevents them using a GoFundMe account to just simply have everybody kind of pay their fines.
Right. I've been caught. I've broken a rule. Now I'm going to have a GoFundMe account so that you out there who support me can pay for this. That's it. I hadn't thought about that. Michael, John Lewis, very upset about this, said he was going to stage a protest on the floor.
John Lewis has a right to be upset about this. I mean, this kind of blew my mind, right, going back to the idea of, Let's just start with First Amendment, right? And if I'm wrong, correct me, but I think this may have been some type of rule that was already in place as far as taking pictures or video.
Yeah,
but now it's this mandatory, right? $500, I think, the first infraction, and then $2,500 after that. But the idea of we're just going to say, our, you know, the people's house, where we should have the most transparency. You cannot, you know, take pictures, videos. We're not supposed to know what's going on. That's problematic.
Well, there's always a live feed when the House is in session going over there. But when both parties have controlled the House, this has been a longstanding policy. There has never been language specific to remedies for violation of that rule, because now we had the situation with the sit-in last year and then the acceleration of technology also. And so you mix those two things together, and that created what happened yesterday.
Tamar, tell me if I'm wrong here. I mean, the basic argument against this is that the Constitution allows the House, in particular, to discipline its own members. But in this case, the rules have kind of shifted that responsibility to the sergeant at arms. The sergeant at arms would be the guy who's levying those fines, and that's likely where we're probably going to see a court challenge.
Exactly. A lot of Democrats are arguing that's unconstitutional, since the sergeant at arms is an employee of the House and not a member himself.
Mm-hmm. Tamar, if it happened, I missed it. John Lewis had said that, I think his office said, they were talking about a moment when Democratic members who are angry about this rule were going to go into the chamber and, if nothing else, hold up their cell phones as a visible sign of protest. Did that, in fact, happen yesterday?
It did. It was pretty brief. All the more striking, though, John Lewis walked into the well of the House and gave a very impassioned speech, comparing the experience yesterday to his experience in 1965, marching in Bloody Sunday, and how you know, Republicans are taking away the freedom of speech of Democrats and people who want to dissent. So it was a, you know, it was a very notable speech.
Rarely do we see a rules package creating a kind of storm of controversy.
It's a new era of politics.
Congressman Lewis called it an unconstitutional gag order.
Compared it to Putin's Russia,
exactly.
Tomorrow, I know we only have you for a limited time, so I want to turn to another issue that you're going to be tracking, obviously, very closely. Donald Trump campaigned throughout the last almost 2 years on his desire to overthrow Obamacare. Of course, the Republican House has tried to do it many, many times, and now the process is underway, correct?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about it.
So the Senate kicked us off just about an hour ago. So they introduced a budget bill that is going to become the vehicle that will lead to an eventual repeal vote. That the vote to repeal likely won't happen until February, March. But this vote that they took today to begin debate on the budget is what's going to start this process. And you already not only have that mechanism going, the congressional repeal, but you also have VP-elect Mike Pence today meeting with Republicans in the House saying that Trump on day one could sign executive orders to also repeal parts of the ACA. So kind of a dual-track approach here to gutting the Affordable Care Act.
And yet they're being very, very careful when they start talking about what's going to replace it.
Yeah. Right, right. And I assume that the conversation that you're hearing up there in the halls tomorrow is still repeal and delay. You know, we can overturn it, but we've got to allow it to continue until we can put a new plan in place.
Exactly. And there still is plenty of disagreement over how long that delay period should be. Conservatives want it to be a shorter period, whereas your more kind of seasoned, more establishment-oriented chairmen are saying, well, we want to get this right. It might take a few years. And there's still disagreement about what they're going to replace it with. So this is the beginning of a very, very long process.
This is going to be the Republicans' biggest challenge with the reward that they have in having majorities in both the House and the Senate and the White House. There's no easy button to how to do this. It's made a little bit easier with the announcement right before the election about the premiums skyrocketing and the copays and deductibles. But there's no easy answer, and it's going to be fun to watch, number one. And the person that's going to be in the middle of it is likely going to be the Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Brown.
Thank you so much for making the transition. That I think we should talk about, Chip. That's right, Tamar. Tom Price, we have now learned, is going to face hearings in, I think, two committees that will weigh in on his nomination as Secretary of HHS. And clearly, Democrats are going to make as much as they can, although they cannot stop him given the rules of the Senate from being approved. But they certainly are going to make a lot about his opposition to Obamacare, to his past statements about privatizing Medicare. He's got a very tough couple of hearings ahead of him, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Democrats are going to make his life as difficult as possible, knowing that they also probably don't have the vote to ultimately kill it, but they want to make it painful.
Yeah, and I will tell you, even down here in Atlanta, you do have people on researching on Price's behalf. Every single bill that man has introduced, every vote that he has cast over the dozen years that he was in the state Senate, and that of course includes an Obama-like bill that he introduced early in his career. And it also, remember, Tom Price was here during all the great Confederate flag debates.
Yes.
You are going to see that pop up in some fashion.
What are we hearing, as long as we're talking about Democrats, nominees or possible nominees for the Trump cabinet? Any word on Sonny Perdue floating around up there tomorrow? There's now talk that he is probably the inside leading candidate to become agriculture secretary. We would have two members of the cabinet from Georgia if that happens.
Yeah, and I'm not going to be able to get much sleep for the next few months. you know, Perdue's allies seem very optimistic about his chances of actually actually getting the nomination. We're expecting to hear probably within the next week or so. It sounds like Trump really wants to round out his cabinet soon. And people are optimistic, but at the same time, they warn, you never know with Trump. He can often change his mind very quickly.
Yeah, so. Yeah, we've got two kind of opposing dynamics here. Number one, the Secretary of Agriculture spot is a position that often goes to the Midwest. But on the other hand, you've got Mike Pence in charge of the transition. A top aide to Mike Pence is Nick Ayers.
Yeah.
And who is Nick Ayers? Nick Ayers is Sonny Perdue's former aide.
Well, I would think you also have to wonder. Look, David Perdue was one of the first members of the U.S. Senate, his cousin, Sonny Perdue's cousin, to stand up and say, I endorse Donald Trump. Perdue himself, David Perdue, took a pass on any possible role in the administration, saying he wants to remain in the Senate. To what extent is this, could a one item in his favor, Chip, be for Sonny Perdue, this is help, this pay, is payback?
Yeah, I think it's a huge, a big gift. I mean, Jim had mentioned Nick as well. I mean, Nick has been very instrumental in this transition. And I will tell you, too, with both parties, president and vice president, over the years, I don't know that we have ever seen as powerful as a vice president as we were with Mike Pence. And news just came out today that not only is he going to have an office on the Senate side of the Capitol, he is also going to have an office on the House side of the Capitol.
Interesting.
As well.
I missed that. All right. Tomorrow, we know you've got to go back to work. What are we going to read about in the paper that with your byline on it tomorrow? Do you know yet, or are you still trying to sort through all of the stories?
Given how much things have changed in the last 36 hours, I can't even begin to predict right now what it'll be.
All right. Listen, thank you so much for being with us. I have to tell you, I think it must be exciting to be in your position right now. I remember my years of getting to come up and watch the first week or so of the legislature going to work. So have fun in the weeks ahead.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tamar. We're going to take a break. But as we do, you know, we said that overnight after this Republican caucus met and decided to defang the Independent Ethics Office, it caused a storm of controversy. And let me tell you, when the late night comics are making hay of it in their monologues, you know you've got trouble. As we go to break, let's listen.
In our nation's capital, our new Congress is back to work, and it is a mess already. House Republicans, last night, the first thing they did when they came to work was vote to disband something called the Office of Congressional Ethics, the group that investigates any congressional wrongdoing. That was the first thing they did. It's the political equivalent of shooting out the surveillance cameras before you rob the bank.
Oh, look at you, Republicans. New year, new you. You know what? Republicans getting rid of the ethics office seems disgusting, but I have to commend them. Because most people make good New Year's resolutions that they can't keep. You know, these guys are just like, this year, I'm going to be less ethical. I'm going to gain 5 pounds, and I'm never, ever going to call grandma again.
Here's the switcheroo. They were supposed to vote on it today, but today, House Republicans pulled the plan after Donald Trump criticized it in a tweet. Man, when Donald Trump calls you out for being unethical, that's a wake-up call.
The U.S. has accepted just a tiny fraction of refugees from Syria. Their reception could get a lot chillier under a new administration.
People that you may have heard may not feel as welcoming. They might be saying some scary things, but I'm here to say that nothing defeats fear like a face.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How Syrian refugees have been welcomed in Toledo, Ohio. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Robert Jimison, our terrific intern, said, Bill, remind people who those comedians were. We heard in order Jimmy Kimmel, Trevor Noah of The Daily Show, and finally Stephen Colbert. You really don't want to be the fodder for those kinds of jokes, Galloway.
I never will be. I promise.
Let's talk about Trump and Russia for a little while. Michael, we have gone through this series. Really what has been sort of, I want to call it a fight, but it isn't because the intelligence community has kind of remained mum on all of this. But even as we're told that Trump is about to get an intelligence briefing in which he's given much more detail about why all of the intelligence agencies think that Russia did play a role in hacking and that may have had an influence on the election. He continues to tweet his skepticism about all of this. The other day, we saw a tweet from him. He thought he was going to get a briefing, I think, on Thursday. The intelligence folks said, no, it's going to be on Friday. He sent out a tweet saying, a delay. Wonder, they may be trying to gather evidence. Well, and the intelligence folks say, no, it was always on Friday. What is going on here?
I think a couple of things. Number one, President-elect Trump does not know hacking, right? He does not. And I speak from that from a background in network security. And I work in cybersecurity, right? So I cringe every time he says something like that. But I also know that he hinges on one bit of truth, and that's that attribution for any cyber attack is very, very, very hard to make, right? So he hinges on that one little thing that someone told him, right? And said it's almost impossible to prove. So he just holds on to that. But the reality of it is that there's a tremendous amount of evidence at least pointing that direction to Russia. One can speculate if it's his private or business, dealings that cause him not to want to, call Russia out, as we've seen in other parts of the world, and deal with other leaders, right? So I'm really questioning this point. Is it just the fact that he wants to hold on to this plausible deniability as long as he can until, he has no other choice?
Any elected official will tell you that political capital is paramount in getting items passed in any type of legislative body, in any type of governing body. And they'll tell you that they probably have the most political capital from the time that they get elected until the time they're sworn in, and then they start losing political capital. And so political capital is invisible currency that you have to spend to get done whatever it is you want to get done, and it doesn't show up in a balance sheet. And so what's baffling to a lot of Republicans is he's not even been sworn in yet. He has more political capital right now than he'll probably ever have, and he's spending so much of it on Vladimir Putin and Russia.
And I think, it's easy to get caught up in his tweets. And I think what we're saying, if you look at the very broadest picture, let's take those tweets about the phone calls that he had with the president of Taiwan, all right, and you compare those with Putin. What you're seeing, either Trump or the people behind Trump, are engaged in the biggest geopolitical shift of U.S. interests that we've seen since Richard Nixon kind of opened the door to China, or we're seeing something random. I don't think we're seeing something random. I think and this is what's got this is what has Republicans split, because I mean forever since the end of World War II, Republicans have been the primary most suspicious people when it comes to the Soviet Union and Russia, and now suddenly he is asking them to change that attitude.
It strikes me that there are two things at play here. One of them is it, and of course I'm speculating. There's no proof of this, but anyone who suggests that Russian hacking may have played a role in Trump's victory, I would think in Trump's mind, suggests to him that they are not giving him the credit he personally deserves for having won this election. Speculation, but based on watching behavior.
Right, but Democrats have been very careful to say that they're not challenging the legitimacy of Trump's victory.
Right. But he doesn't want to believe that anything interferes with the power that he has to win this.
He's already upset that he lost the popular vote. That bothers him. And so you're exactly right, Bill. And so that's what it's boiling down to. But, as Republicans, we got to see. I mean, what concerns us the most? The fact that he's taunting Kim Jong-un and North Korea, or the fact that it looks like he's now decided he wants to be friends with and trusts Russia and Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, I think at some point here, we have to rise above some of this on a partisan level. I mean, because what we're seeing here, anytime we're talking about hacking, in a global form, weaponizing the capability of war fighting and cyber warfare. It's a scary premise, right? And the idea that we can take every single one of these issues and make them completely partisan, I think we lose a little bit of the scope and what we really should be dealing with, right?
Right. And that is where there's potential for Trump and the Republican Congress to find themselves at odds, because there certainly are members of both the Senate and the House, Republicans, who are very concerned about the Russian hacking. Sure.
Look at Paul Ryan's comments today about Julian Assange. So I mean, it's already started. It will be a unique type relationship that they'll be agreeing at 9 a.m. about something, and then they'll disagree at 3 p.m. on something, and that's not a dynamic we've seen.
So recently, I suggested that there are two things for me that come into play here. One, Trump's own desire to claim all credit with no outside interference for winning the election. But the other, Jim, is this rush to embrace Vladimir Putin, to not do anything to upset what he seems to believe can be a very warm and possibly productive relationship with Russia. Now, we really don't have any reason to I mean, it could be a productive relationship, possibly. But last week, we invited Nikolay Kapasov to come into the studio and spend a few minutes with us. He is a professor of history. He was teaching in Russia, helped found a university there, and eventually left the country because the subject that he was teaching, which was the memory and history, kind of ran afoul of the Putin regime. And so he came to the United States, where he did go to work first at Georgia Tech and then at Emory. And we wanted to talk to him about what he thinks about Trump's outreach to Putin and whether it will pay off. We just have a couple of brief sound bites we're going to play for you today. He's Russian. If you have trouble understanding, we'll kind of interpret it. But let's listen to what he said about a friendship between Putin and Trump.
If you ask me whether I believe Trump will succeed becoming friends with Putin, I'm kidding. No.
He doesn't see it. Do any of you think that Putin is ready to put aside his KGB past and become a friend of the American president?
Depends on what he wants.
Let's listen to something else that he said. We asked him whether he thinks that Putin remains the biggest threat, potentially, that a Trump administration will face. He doesn't. And this is what he said about that.
I'm not saying that Russia is the biggest danger for the U.S. Of course, there are other countries which are far more dangerous, China. But in the perspective of maybe 10 years, 15 years or so, Russia will be, of course, playing a very dangerous role in international politics, and it can by no means be ignored.
Dr. Kapasov points out that, as we know, Vladimir Putin's background is as a KGB agent. He always has an agenda. Mm-hmm. So interesting to hear those perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with cozying up to Putin is that if you're looking across the Atlantic toward Moscow, you've got Angela Merkel in between, it's going to be very tough to be best friends with Vladimir Putin and still offer any respect to Germany.
Right. No question.
All right. We're going to have to follow that. I want to take that one step further because we've already mentioned Julian Assange. But, you know, so the American public and certainly Trump voters have perhaps bought into his questioning whether or not the intelligence community is correct or not correct about Russian hacking. They may be more willing to listen to Trump than the intelligence community. We don't know. We will see how this plays out. But in the meantime, you have the Trump-friendly media doing what it can to undermine the intelligence community's assertions. And I thought it was worth playing just a little bit of an interview that Fox News' Sean Hannity did the other night with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And I think it's worth listening to because you hear how Hannity is laying the groundwork, furthering the groundwork for questioning the authenticity and reliability of the intelligence community's reporting. Hannity went to London, spent an hour with Assange. Here's just one brief highlight.
The main focus for most Americans, they are being told by Hillary Clinton's campaign, by the President of the United States, there are the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, etc., that in fact WikiLeaks was working with the Russian government to influence the election. Is that true in any way, shape, matter, or form?
No, that's absolutely false. And if you read their statements carefully, you'll see they don't actually say that. They kind of mentioned one fact here and one fact there and nothing else.
There you have it, Chip Lake. Julian Assange says, nope, didn't happen. That's the end of that.
Yeah, it's been a strange 24 hours, and it's going to continue to be. You know, when you have the president-elect of the United States, no matter what party he is, questioning his own United States intelligence agencies and being deferential to Julian Assange, who is housed up in a Ecuadorian embassy in another country, it could be a very interesting
I want to hear from our tech security guy here.
You know, the biggest issue that I'm having probably with this is that And I think this past week with Trump's press secretary speaking along those same lines, right, that maybe it was the DNC's fault because, you know, their security wasn't tight enough or, you know, some of these spear phishing attacks were successful. Well, you know what? That's what it's supposed to do, right? And that's where they work towards. But the idea that, you know, there's hacks that happen all the time, right, and we see those. This has been systematically different, right? The fact that you have a potential foreign country, or let's say it's not Russia as a country, but we know that Russia has previously used, you know, hacking organizations that are not directly tied to the government. But the aspect of having a foreign body attack a political organization, U.S. organization, with the intent potentially of influencing or maliciously having something to do with an election— is something that we have never happened before.
But let me do to that to the point your earlier point and some accusations that are coming out of the Trump office about what responsibility did the Democratic National Committee have to make sure that it was upgraded? I mean, sure. You are dealing with a bunch of old fogies in that office who barely know how to use email.
Yeah. What I can tell you is that I always say security is to the nth degree, right? You can apply layers and layers and layers on top of a security, but, you know, with these advanced persistent threats, I mean, they're just going to hammer away till they find some way to get in.
And there's also pretty strong evidence that the RNC server was hacked as well, but none of those emails were released. We don't know if that's the case or not, sure. But you know, that could be playing into this as well, knowing that they might have a trove of Republican emails that have not been released.
People are tweeting us at PoliticsGPB as they're listening to the conversation. Let me just share a couple of them with you right now. One of them from Thought Crime, who tweets at Raw Dog Buffalo, says John Podesta, of course, he was the chairman of the Clinton campaign, and it was his emails more than anything else that were really hacked into and dumped, thousands and thousands of them over a period of weeks. Thought Crime says Podesta's email password was password. Ask yourself, how much hacking is required to hack that?
Yeah, and that's another thing I was going to say, right? It's all about security awareness, right? You can spend millions of dollars securing systems, and then, you know, you look under someone's keyboard, and there's a sticky note with their password on it, right? So that happens all the time. It's unfortunate, but it does.
Ted Barfield, who tweets at T_Barf, it says, this is not rocket science. He, meaning Trump, continues to push back on alleged Russian hacking to poke the media, who freak at his every tweet. And, you know, he makes a point. I do think, and Jim, this isn't, we're not going to get into a long media conversation today. We will do that at some other time. But it is certainly true that at a point, all of the journalists who cover this administration are going to have to reflect on how far we go in highlighting the Trump tweets and making them the story of the day. He has played everyone beautifully in that regard.
And I hope we have started in my shop, we have started kind of judiciously ignoring this and that. and immediately discounting some. When Donald Trump says, I know more than a lot of people about this hack, and I'm going to tell you on Tuesday or Wednesday, well, the man has said absolutely nothing to me.
Sure.
So I would argue, and Chip, I throw this to you because you're our Republican today. I would argue, I know that there are some Trump supporters who would suggest that if we ignore Trump tweets or play them down or just don't go all the way with him on these things, that we're somehow biased against Trump. I want to make a different point. I suggest that if we don't pay as much attention to Trump tweets as maybe he wants us to, we might in the long run be helping him clear the deck for doing some policy-oriented work.
Look, the media's in a tough spot here, and I hate to be in a position to defend the mainstream press, but
we've never had
a president or president-elect that has used this medium of communication like Donald Trump has, and so it's going to have some advantages for him to get his message directly to the voters and get it out, but there's no way if a president of the United States decides he wants to communicate in this way, it has to be covered. And look, let's be candid about it. It's pretty big news what he's been writing on Twitter. They're not birthday wishes to and congratulating Little League ball teams. This is big news. So I think it has to be covered. But you know, to what point over the 4-year term, we'll have to wait and see.
All right, we're going to have to take our second break of the show. We're here with Chip Lake, Republican strategist, Michael Owens, who is the chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County, and our good friend, Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. By the way, tomorrow's Thursday. What are you writing for tomorrow?
The kind of non-fight between the Senate Republican caucus in the state capitol and Josh McCoon.
Oh, all right. Yeah, we'll talk. Let's talk just a little about that when we come back, because we do want to turn to state and local news. It's 2:47 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Jim, Josh McCoon was stripped. Here's the guy who, for three sessions and promising going into a fourth, has been fighting for religious liberty measures. And he's run afoul of just about every leader at the Capitol. But he's determined. He believes in it, what he's fighting for. And he lost a little power because of this.
Yeah, well, he is in the process of losing power. It hasn't actually happened yet. What the Senate has agreed to combine a couple judiciary committees. And by gosh, they have one chairman too many. And so he is likely to be the one lost. And of course, he is the fellow who's been pushing not just religious liberty, but ethics. He has introduced legislation, and although he's quickly replied it, to restrict the power of the governor to term limit the speaker.
What does he think this is, North Carolina?
it has made him a persona non grata in the House. So anything with his name on it isn't going to pass. And the Senate leadership has finally reacted to that. They understand that, he at least needs to be placed in the cooling saucer of the Senate, if you will.
Look, whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, every elected official down at the Capitol has their niche. And what a lot of people who aren't immersed in this space like we are don't understand is many times there are often more disagreements within the parties than there are between the parties. And I think how Josh McCoon has gone about those differences internally has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And it fits into the MO. It fits into the narrative of what he wants. But this is likely a byproduct of that type of style. Look, I like Josh. He's a friend. He believes strongly in what he believes in. But I don't know that the way he's chosen to conduct himself at the Capitol has been productive for what he's for the issues he's trying to push or for being in position to trying to influence those.
On one hand, losing that chairmanship, he loses access to a lot of campaign contributions. But on the other hand, He does.
He's a martyr.
He does have that. He does get that martyrdom status with the GOP base.
Yeah. Well, after the, the determination yesterday from the Fulton County Court about DACA. I'm sure he can't be too happy about that either.
Oh, I'm really glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
That will become another
that
cause.
That was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Michael, can you explain what you're referring to?
Yeah, I think it was basically upheld from the federal government in the stand that if you are a not necessarily a citizen, but if you are here in the state, in the country legally,
if you have
right,
legal
by
status,
way of
right.
Georgia, right, you should be able to get in-state tuition. And that's something, a fight that's been going on for a while, since I think there was about 10 students that initially had filed the lawsuit. And, you know, the idea kind of goes back. It makes me think about a couple of years ago with Governor Deal when it was talking about the refugees, right, and having the ability to come in. Well, once you establish legal status in the country, right, to my knowledge, no state can actually say, yeah, in the country, but not this state, right? So I think the aspect of that win yesterday was huge. But maybe not too much to.
It could be a very, very temporary.
Oh, I was just going to say, we're talking about a Fulton County court, and this thing is going to be heard beyond the Fulton County courts.
And more importantly, you've got Trump, who within say 3 or 4 weeks could sign an executive order that ends this DACA program.
Sure.
You know, Jim, I don't know when you guys are polling over at the AJC again, or whether I don't recall whether this question has come up. But I think it would be fascinating to learn where Georgians stand on the question of whether the DACA kids, the kids who President Obama, through executive order, said we've got to protect them. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, I think is what it
stands
for.
I could write that poll question to get any results that you want.
Depending on how you phrase the question.
Yeah. Do you want to send these children who know no other language but English into a country that they've never seen before? That's one way to phrase it.
Well,
or do you want to reward people who have crossed the border illegally?
Okay, I get that. But I was intrigued in reading the Atlanta Journal-Constitution article about it, because I get a lot of my news from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Jim. That even Tea Party leader Debbie Dooley was quoted in the piece today as saying, on one hand, she feels real sympathy for these young people. She did go on to say she still thinks that they shouldn't get the kind of what she thinks of as special treatment. But I do think that the emotions of many people would be in
this is I'm not sure whether he still holds this position, but people like Mike Huckabee, Republican presidential candidate. He went back to his religious training and his religious teachings to say that these kids don't deserve to be punished for the actions of their parents. Mm-hmm. And that still has, I mean, that has, in a Trump climate, that sentiment has lessened, but it still exists on the Republican side, I think.
Okay, as we wind down toward the end of the show, Jim, let's talk just for a few minutes. We got a mayor's race coming up in Atlanta at the end of 2017. Thank goodness we do, because we never want to be without an election here on Political Rewind. And you wrote an interesting column the other day about former Governor Roy Barnes and his decision to endorse quite early in this race. We don't have a lot of time today, but give us the headlines.
Well, they've got there's a fundraiser this week at Colony Square for Vincent Ford, and it's being the main headliner on it is Roy Barnes. A secondary headliner on it is David Scott, the congressman who represents a whole lot of Atlanta, a good bit of Cobb, maybe Douglas County. Mm-hmm. And that's ideologically, it's a really interesting combination. Scott is one of your most conservative Democrats in Congress. Barnes is kind of a middle of the road kind of guy. Vincent Fort has got this reputation as a liberal bomb thrower. He's trying to address that a little bit, but it speaks of maybe something that's being formed that could last into the 2018 race for governor, which would be very interesting, I think.
Michael, you're up in Cobb, but you're going to watch this with great interest. It does appear that Roy Barnes is siding with Vincent Fort. Yeah, they worked together on a loan bill, on a payday loan package back when Barnes was governor, and they did seem to get along pretty well. I find it an odd combination. Barnes is the conservative Democrat, and as Jim points out, Vincent has been a bomb thrower.
Yeah. I see it as very odd, right? And then you throw in Congressman Scott into the mix, and all kind of eyebrows start going up and down, right? And I've heard some people, you know, talk about to hark back to the state Senate when they may or may not have all served together at the same time. But obviously, there's some long-standing bonds there. Part of this may be Vincent Fort's effort to kind of get a little more mainstream, come back a little bit, and maybe have some big heavy hitters that can endorse him and say, yeah, he's really not the wild card, you know, that you guys want to say that he is.
All right.
Well, no, but we have to jump in here.
That's right.
This afternoon.
Right.
This afternoon.
Yep.
We had an email from Kasim Reed saying, mm-hmm. hold the date. There's a hold the date for a fundraiser for Keisha Lance Bottoms, who may be his candidate now in the race for mayor.
All right. Fortunately, we have a lot of time to talk about the Atlanta mayor's race in the months ahead. We're out of time now to talk more. Chip Lake, so glad to have you here. Michael Owens, thank you for being with us. And Jim Galloway, always great to have you sitting over there keeping me honest. A couple of notes before we leave you today. First of all, Monday is January 9th is not only the first day of the legislative session, but it is the day that we begin officially a 3-day-a-week schedule here on Political Rewind, which we're all really excited about. We'll be here Mondays and Wednesdays at 2. And then just to keep you on your guard, Fridays at 3 o'clock. So we hope you will join us for 3 shows a week starting on Monday. I also want to point out that we on Monday are also going to begin, if you start checking the Political Rewind website, which you'll find at gpbnews.org, we're going to start posting what I think of, and I will tell you, I'm curating this myself, some of the most interesting political articles I read on a given day in the major American newspapers. Not a lot, maybe 5, 6, just to say to you, here are some articles that we think will be of interest to you, whether they're the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, New York Times, who knows? Maybe the Drudge Report will be a part of it all.
Well, the AJC, certainly.
Oh, well, the AJC, of course. That's a given. So I hope you'll join us for that, too. So that's basically just about it for us. Robert Jimison, we appreciate your work today. Senior producer Jenny Amond, thank you. And producer Lisa Clark, who became an official producer on Political Rewind and Two-Way Street just yesterday. Thank you for all that you're doing for us as well. So as we close today, I wanted to give you a little milestone. January 4th today is a real day of note for students of Georgia politics and for Georgia politicians. Jim, it was on this day in 1995 that Newton LeRoy McPherson Gingrich was formally elected as the 50th Speaker of the House of Representatives. He was the first Republican in 40 years to get the Speaker's gavel, but he was the third Georgian to assume the role. Howell Cobb and Charles Crisp served in those roles, in that role, in the 1800s. So,
happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, Newt Gingrich. I'm Bill Nygut. That's it for us today. We'll see you here on Friday at 3 o'clock for another edition of Political Rewind.